Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing topics that some listeners may find disturbing.
If you're still listening, you're a weirdo, but you're our kind of weirdo.
Hi guys.
Hi guys.
Welcome to this latest episode of Slaughter, the podcast.
We have some news for you today.
This episode, as well as being our latest, is actually going to be our last episode for the foreseeable.
Yeah, so we've had quite a lot going on. I mean, you've probably noticed that we've been a bit more absent on the socials. Is that what people say nowadays? Yeah. We've both got some news. So I am 22 weeks pregnant.
Yay, she's going to have a baby. And at the start of this year, I got engaged and we'll be starting a wedding. And we've both got a lot more responsibility in our jobs. And
well,
until you
leave. For a bit.
But I just think, as you'll have noticed, our upload schedule has been definitely disturbed. And we just got to the point where actually we can't deliver the content that our listeners deserve as regularly as they would like it.
So we're not saying it's forever, but we're not putting a time period on it.
Yes. At the minute, there are no plans to restart, but we haven't fallen out.
Well.
Not that she's told me. There is no secret drama to it, though.
No.
At all. Just a change in life circumstances. And we have absolutely loved the last 3 years. I've loved getting to spend so much time with my friend every week.
I mean, once I got over the fact that we're not like the most famous podcast out there, I've still really loved it, and you guys have been such a fabulous load of fans. And we do have a last episode for you, so we're not just gonna put this message out. Like, we've got one more murder each,
one more to go,
to share with you today. So I think we should just get started.
Yeah, have a listen to this.
Okay, so I am going to be telling you about the murder of Teresa de Simone. It's quite a famous one, but I didn't know it very well.
I feel like by now people could play Slaughter Bingo, and one of the things they would say is, it's a well-known case, but we've never heard of it.
Yeah. I think we say that all the time. I think because it was a bit overshadowed by, because it was this 1979, it was kind of in the heat of the Yorkshire Ripper.
Okay.
So that kind of comes up a bit, actually. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the victim, Teresa. I don't know if it's Teresa or Teresa.
Teresa.
Teresa. But she was born in 1957 and she was an only child. Her parents separated when she was young and her mother remarried. She was quite a shy child, but she did have quite a few friends. And she kind of just went through school, sort of like under the radar. And then she got a job as a clerk at the gas board as her main job. But she was pretty hardworking. She wanted to pay for her own car. So she got a job in a bar a couple of nights a week as well. And she wanted to meet some friends that way. I think you kind of do get a bit of a social life when you work at a bar, don't you?
Definitely. You get a few regulars that come on down. People just... Everyone who comes up is inclined to chat with you. Like, yeah. They're all really happy to see you. They're like, give me the alcohol. Yeah. I love you. You're the best. You gave me the alcohol.
Exactly. Like, so she got a job at a place called Tom Tackle. And this was all in Southampton. So December 5th, 1979, the bar closes at 11 p.m. And Teresa usually stays and, like, cashes up and like gets rid of the regulars, is like drink up. And but this night she left dead on time because her friend Jenny was there, because it was Jenny's birthday and they both wanted to go out dancing, but they're only going to go for a couple of hours because it was a work night, so they both had work the next day. So Jenny is at the bar and then they leave together, and Anthony Pocock closes up alone. He's the owner. And Teresa and Jenny then drive, even though it's only a short distance really, in Jenny's car to the local club.
Okay.
And then, so they left Teresa's car at the Tom Tackle. The plan is that they're going to go out, have a couple of hours dancing, go back to get the car, and then they'll both drive home.
I'm going to say this started out really low key. Like, we've got work in the morning, just a couple of drinks. Oh, fuck it. Let's drive to the club and go dancing. No.
But, neither were drinking. They were just like sober night, just have a bit of a dance. So they went.
See, that's because it's the 70s and there must have been dance routines. You don't need to feel self-conscious about dancing when everyone knows the moves.
I mean, I'm calling it the club, but it was very much called the disco in every every document I looked. I just can't bring myself to say
down
it.
Down to the discotheque.
Exactly. It's just so like 50s dad, isn't it? So both Teresa and Jenny left and then at the bar or the club just before 1 o'clock, and they drove the half a mile back to Tom Tackle, and Jenny parks up right near Teresa's car, says goodbye, and she drives off. So Teresa gets out, she gets her keys out from her bag, and then climbs in the car, and she's about to start the engine when a young man knocks on the window and just points at his wrist like, what's the time? Now it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, bit weird, but she thinks, oh, he looks super young, I don't know, like,
yeah, they're outside the pub, maybe he's thinking like, are you open, are you closed, maybe? Yeah.
So she rolls down the window to tell him, and he grabs her wrist and reaches in and unlocks the door, doing like the little pull button.
Yeah.
And then opens it and pushes her into the car and gets into the driver's seat. I imagine it being the 70s, it's kind of like, do you know, the whole like front seat is like one seat.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have a gap, do you? So he pushes her along, gets in the driver's seat, and then he slams the door behind him. Enough to say, like, local residents actually hear, they reported hearing the door slam. Mm. And then he grabs her by the throat, because obviously she's screaming, and begins pulling at her clothes, like, her exposes her breast, and then pulls her into the back of the car, rapes her, and then strangles her to death. Horrific. Really graphic. I mean, there's more to it, but there's no need for me to go into the gory details, but it's like, it's a violent attack. Yeah. It's nasty. So Teresa's mother knows immediately the next morning when she gets up and Teresa's not home, something is wrong. This is not like her at all. So she sent her husband to the Tom Tackle, and he sort of pulls up and then looks in the car park and sees that her car's still there. But he doesn't go over and look at it. He just assumes she's left it there, she's gone somewhere. So he drives home and tells mum that she'd left the car there, but he doesn't know where she is. And then at 10 a.m., the owner, Anthony Pocock, comes back and he arrives to sort of unlock the pub and get ready for some deliveries. And he's quite surprised that her car is still there, and actually it's blocking the spot for the delivery truck. So he thinks, oh, that's kind of annoying. I'm going to go over and just see maybe if I can roll it, because she's probably at her day job now anyway. So he put phoning her. So he gets over to the car and looks in the back, and he can see Teresa's body, partly clothed, covered in blood, bruises, and he phones the police immediately. So police confirm, obviously, she's been murdered, and the murder didn't happen quickly either. So it wasn't like a quick strangulation. They could tell from the bruising, and also there was like foam around her mouth that she'd been sort of like strangled to near death, and then it'd been released multiple times before she was finally killed, which was awful. And
it's
then
surprising that he hasn't made any attempt to hide the body.
None at all.
A lot of sort of serial killers that will do to avoid being caught will at least try and bury it in some sort of shit, or dump it in a woods or something. Like,
but this is pre-DNA as well. Like, it's just,
oh, okay, like, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, like, I clearly it's someone who doesn't know her, and they just think, whoa, well, tough shit. Also semen is found on her body as well, but all they can do is they can confirm from the blood and the blood found on her that the killer was either type A or type AB blood type. Okay. Teresa's murder, having been a young woman and then obviously savage, brutal murder, is heavily featured on the news for a few weeks. But as I mentioned before, Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, was killing women in large numbers. So he committed two murders that year. And obviously there was all the hype that went around that. So press coverage quite quickly stopped on Teresa's murder. The police obviously continued to look into it, but they didn't really have any leads. There was no witness who'd seen anyone in particular. It was at her workplace. But then a man called Sean Hodgson, who was a prisoner at Wandsworth Prison, confesses to a murder at the Tom Tackle in Southampton. Oh. So I'm going to tell you a bit about him. So Sean was born in Ireland, but he grew up in Durham. He began to get involved in criminal activity, mostly stealing, about age 11, and he was sent to Borstal. He left there as a teenager, repeatedly arrested, repeatedly in trouble for the law, stealing cars, owning weapons. He also got in trouble for having sex with a minor. So that kind of was classed as rape because it was deemed she couldn't give consent. Yeah. He was diagnosed with a personality disorder, which I still don't really understand.
Sounds like he's got that full set.
What's a personality disorder? Does it just mean
like borderline?
You're a dick.
Or antisocial personality disorder.
Yeah, like APD, I guess. Yeah.
Just generic sociopath.
Yeah. And a compulsive liar. And he also took a lot of drugs. So on the day of Teresa's murder, he could actually be placed in Southampton. He'd arrived and he'd booked into a hostel and he'd been arrested for theft within 48 hours. So sometime between being in the hostel and being arrested again.
He was already up to no good.
Yeah. After he was arrested, he had actually been asked about the murder immediately and he'd blamed someone that he knew. But they looked into this and seen that the man that he blamed had an O group blood type. So he was sort of ruled out. So although Sean was odd, they didn't really have any reason. Like, they'd arrest him for theft. There's no reason to say, oh, he must be the murderer as well. So, you know, this was months before his confession. So on December the 11th, 1980, a year after the murder, Sean Hodgson had visited the prison chaplain at Wandsworth. He's from a Catholic family. I mean, he's Irish, so no surprise. And he said he was being tormented by nightmares of the face of a woman he'd killed a year ago in Southampton. So the chaplain couldn't actually tell anyone at that point because the confessional booth is sacred. So you can't actually... Which is really shocking, I guess. But I guess if you didn't have that, no one would tell them anything.
That is true. I wonder how many really big... I was going to say, I wonder how many secrets Catholic priests know about, but I'm sure they've got plenty.
Fuck, Lou.
I don't really want to know.
No. But I wonder, like, that would be a real burden to live with if you were one of the good priests and someone confessed a murder to you. So... Then Sean confessed the next day to a prison officer who obviously was allowed to tell people. And then he wrote a note stating the location had been the Tom Tackle.
So that's such an odd name as well. And so so specific that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Surely it's not a false confession. And it won't have been on the news.
It was on the news.
Recently, though, if it's a year later that he confessed.
No, not necessarily. So Southampton police were contacted by the police officer and the police staff at the prison. And they arrived in London on the 15th December to interrogate Sean. Now, Sean had confessed to a number of crimes prior to this. So this wasn't his first confession. And the other crimes he'd confessed to, it just wasn't even possible that he would have been able to commit them. So, but in this case, he actually obviously was in Southampton and he had a lot of details of the crime. So he knew that the death had been slow and that hadn't been reported in the press rather than a quick strangulation. He had details of a watch that had been taken from Teresa's body and he mentioned himself having tried to sell a watch after the crime. He also said how she'd gotten into the car by sitting at a certain angle and like swinging her legs in. And then when they spoke to Teresa's mother, she said, oh yeah, she did get into a car. Like that's like how she got in cars.
With both the legs. Can you imagine that something? What will I, if we died, what will I remember about
you? She went through the sunroof.
The way she used to clamber into a car. I just love it. I'm convinced it's him now, so don't try and twist this on me because
all right,
I'm
the end. So after extensive interviews, Sean was taken to Southampton and he gave details of where he disposed of Teresa's belongings. He also provided lots and lots of written confessions. So like he was like writing them in his cell, he handed some in, some got found in his cell as well. And then on the 25th and the 27th of December, he also confessed to two other crimes, but no evidence that these crimes ever existed. So it's a bit weird because he's going into loads of detail about this crime and knows loads about it. But then he's just like randomly mentioning this. Like he said, oh, I murdered this gay guy. That it was just, there was no crime evidence.
And those are definitely false confessions.
Been murdered at all. So he continued to add details about Teresa's murder in the same time. Like he said that he'd thrown up in a certain area when he was walking away from the crime and that someone nearby had put on a light and looked over at him. And then a witness that they'd actually asked, that like they knew that someone had turned on a light in that area because they said, oh, I heard something and I turned on a light.
Oh.
So
he must have.
Yeah, there's loads of details. There's also... they found a pen in the car and said, have you seen this pen before? And he went, yeah, I've seen that pen. I've actually got a match. It's my pen. I've got another pen like that in green in my cell. And they went and looked in his cell and found that pen. And also they found a comb in the car. And he said...
and he had hair!
But he said, that's my comb. I've scratched my initials in it. So they looked at the comb.
Right. If it had his initials, then case closed.
It didn't have his initials, but it did have scratches that they said they weren't not his initials.
Okay.
They're like, there's some scratches. For someone who's like maybe incompetent at scratching initials,
yeah,
these are deliberate scratches. And also, yes, it was the type of comb given to inmates. So,
and he'd just been released, hadn't he? Like 2 days before this murder.
So, and Sean's blood group was group A as well. So based on all of that, I mean, they haven't actually got any, obviously, DNA proof. It's all circumstantial. But because of all this circumstantial evidence, they arrest Sean Hodgson and charge him with Teresa's rape and murder. Now, as trial approaches, which is quite quick, actually, because I think it mentioned that it was going to happen in January, he begins to backpedal. And he says he lied and that he's a fantasist and he's always making up that he's done these crimes. And which is true. But the case wasn't totally just built on his confession. It was built on all these other evidence that admittedly he'd provided answers for. But it's like, how would he have known a lot of those details? Like you're saying,
yeah,
there's just no way. The trial lasted 15 days. Sean actually refused to enter the witness box or be cross-examined. He didn't give an alibi. He didn't say, actually, no, I made it up. I was really here. Or
he just said, forget I ever said anything.
Yeah, or give any reasons for why he'd mentioned anything. So with no alternative, it's only going to go one way anyway. So he was found guilty within 3 hours and he received life in prison. So almost as soon as he received that sentence, he appealed on claims he had used details he had got from the TV or newspapers. And his lawyer also said, well, he'd guessed the other stuff. The stuff he couldn't have known, he guessed and he just happened to get lucky. Now, they didn't take that as... they said, well, that's, you're not telling us anything new there, so we're not going to accept that appeal. So Sean's in prison for this crime. While Sean's in prison, several other people make confessions to the murder. One was a David Lace, a young man, but there's a whole string of these same kind of confessions. There's like people with a long criminal record give details of the crime, nothing you couldn't find that wasn't in the papers, lots of inaccuracies, like this particular guy didn't give the right number of doors to the car. He said it was a like a 5-door, even though it was a 3-door. Yeah. Couldn't remember what she was wearing. And 6 other people made similar confessions, but none of them were really taken that seriously because, I mean, these 7 people can't have also killed Teresa. It's, you just, what can you do with that? And Sean just, it must be him. So in prison, Sean becomes very depressed. He was actually transferred to Broadmoor and spent 8 years there before returning to prison. And then DNA comes in.
Good.
Yeah,
let's see. Hear the answer. See, now I'm starting to think, actually, I was a bit quick to jump the gun before, because we've seen from Making a Murderer that, I mean, we're saying, oh, he said he that's his comb and he says she died slowly, but we know that police can ask enough questions where, or enough leading questions to make it seem like he came up with the details when he didn't really.
And actually, yeah, there were no transcripts of his interviews. There were very detailed notes, but there was no like recording or video or anything like that.
And if you know someone was strangled to death, you could probably guess that it was a slow death. Is that really a detail that we didn't know?
But like the getting in the car and the comb and the pen.
How did she get in the car though, really? There's only really one way to get in the car. What, you either put your feet in first or your bum in first?
She put both. She
or
put
what,
bum
she
in first.
Hands and knees on the seat and then crawls in.
How bum first, both feet swivel.
She won't. That won't be the only person to do that. How do you get in the car?
Left foot first, bum down, right foot second. Unless I'm getting in the passenger side, of course. That would be weird.
I think I'd probably do the same. But a lot of people wearing skirt. If you're wearing a skirt, you probably would do bum down swivel.
Maybe. That's true.
So let's see what the DNA's got to say.
It must have been dead exciting when DNA came in because all these... If you were like... I guess there weren't
sleuths. They're like, finally, let's check everything.
Yeah, like... I don't know, it's pretty exciting times. Anyway.
If we have any listeners left after our initial message, they will be screaming right now, being like, just tell us they did it! Like, the is it his DNA or not?
Right.
Been dragged out.
Anyway, so obviously DNA comes in and then there's a backlog of crimes that are being revisited. They're not going to just do all the crimes in the first month. It doesn't happen like that. And also you've got to have someone there to ask for it. So eventually one of Sean's lawyers puts in a crest and for semen samples to be tested from the murder. Sean is willing to provide DNA to provide a comparison. And then the Forensic Science Service, or FSS, who were basically kind of left with the job of doing DNA profiling. Like they collected DNA profiles for criminals, but also they would run the DNA scans. They said, we can't find any of the samples. They're gone. So that's it for a while. So for 10 years, nothing happens. He's depressed in prison. No one looks into it. Then in 2008, he gets a new legal team. He's been in prison for years. So a guy called Rag Chand is his lawyer. I mean, I kind of think that name you could get away with in America, but...
Rag Chand.
In Britain... Yeah, not so much. But he located evidence that actually was stored in the Midlands in an industrial park that the Forensic Science Service had not had on file. And it had swabs from the murder. So still just like randomly in this, I guess, police warehouse place. So they get their hands on these swabs. In 2009, it's confirmed that the DNA found on Teresa's body could not have been... from Sean Hodgson.
Oh.
It's not a match. So his conviction is overturned. He served 27 years.
I mean, I hate to say he asked for it, but he did ask for it several times, verbally and in writing.
Literally, that is, no one ever like said, we're sorry, because we were like, oh, you did kind of give us no choice, mate. You did kind of bring this on yourself. Anyway, I don't know if you'll feel too sorry for him later anyway. But now they had a murderer walking free, unpunished as well. The Forensic Science Service had DNA profiling on a lot of criminals that... so when someone was arrested from the 1990s on, their DNA was kept on file, and if they re-offended, it was put into the database, I think. So they called the kind of operation to find out who actually had been the killer Operation Iceberg. I don't know why. Maybe the air can, like the heaters are broken in the building. Yeah. Like they were. So no DNA match was found when they put it through the system. However, they did find a partial match. And when you get a partial match...
Like a fraternal match?
Yeah, it's likely it's someone related to the murderer. So there'll be like parts of the DNA that do match and parts don't, because they've obviously they've got the same parents. So the FSS pulled the name and checked living family members and found that a sister was still alive from the person who had this. So it was a bloke who'd been in trouble with the law loads of times, and then his sister was still alive. So they went and met with her, asked for her DNA. She gave it over, and again, she was a partial match. So obviously it's not her. So there was one brother left of this three sibling group, but he was deceased, called David Lace.
And David looked at the comb and it was a DL.
No, but David Lace, who 18 months after Teresa's murder had confessed to it.
No.
Yes. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. So David Williams was born in 1962 in Portsmouth, and he had a troubled childhood, early involvement in criminal activity. He was actually given up for adoption because his family decided they couldn't cope with him, and he ended up taking their last name, so he became David Lace. But he didn't really work very well in this adopted family either. He was kind of unruly. They couldn't cope with him. So he was ordered to go live in a hostel as a young man, so age 17. And the problem with the hostel was it only worked if you agreed to live there. It wasn't like under lock and key. Mm. So on December 4th, day before the murder, 1979, he'd ransacked the other rooms, walked from the hostel 20 miles to Southampton. And he had stated in the confession that he'd made 18 months after the murder that he'd seen Jenny drop Therese off, and then he'd attacked her as she got into her car. But by the time that he'd confessed, Sean Hodgson had already been convicted of the crime, and six others had confessed with no extra details they could provide. So he was just the seventh in a long string of people.
Yeah, and by that time, confessing. He'd be like...
Oh, another one. And also, he'd clearly shown that he couldn't cope outside of an institution, and he clearly wanted to go back to prison. So you've got motive for lying as well. So he hadn't been taken seriously. No one at any point really blamed the police for any of this, because they were like, look, this guy's giving them an answer for everything. This guy doesn't know fuck all and wants to go back to prison. Like, why? It wouldn't make sense to...
Yeah. You can say that they should have done something different, but common sense would dictate exactly that everyone would make the same decision.
Yeah. So in December 1988, Lace had actually told a lot of his friends he had great remorse for some of his previous actions. He'd got very depressed, and he actually slashed his arms, put a bag over his head, swallowed sleeping tablets, and he was found dead and was buried in Portsmouth. So he'd committed suicide, blaming like his past actions and the fact they'd gone unpunished as part of that.
Oh.
So August 12th, 2009, after all this has come out...
If he comes back from the dead, I'm going to... My mind is already blown.
They go to his grave and they open it up and they take his DNA from the corpse, and it's a perfect match. So they have their murderer. He was actually never found guilty because they didn't do a retrial, but it was pretty... clear, it was publicly reported that he was the murderer, and Teresa's mother spoke out thanking the police for reinvestigating the crime. Now Sean was entitled to quite a lot of money. I think they gave him 250,000 initially. I'm not sure if he got any more after that. I think just because the process for deciding how much he should be able to claim and his appeals and things can take a long time, so they just said just bung him some money, and he bought a house quite close to where he'd grown up. And the press kind of like reported him as this innocent guy, poor guy. He went down for a crime he didn't commit. 27 years he was punished for this.
He was already in prison.
Yeah, and also 2010. I mean, he only got out in 2009. 2010, he raped a woman with learning
difficulties.
A woman with learning difficulties, apparently. Like, she came forward and accused him of rape. He was found guilty of sexual assault in the end. He said it wasn't rape, but yeah, I did touch her up. So he received a community order. So I don't think that ever made the press, but they were very kind of nice about him in the press and painted him as this innocent person. He also went to prison as well for drink driving, and he died in 2012, age 61. But it also remains a question, how the hell did he know all the details about the murder? Did he happen across the crime scene? Was it just really lucky guesses with this comb and the pen? And
but then if they're showing him a pen and he says, yeah, I recognize it, like,
yeah, I know, it's
easily
it is
done, isn't it? Oh, there's a comb, yeah, that's mine. Like, he's just agreeing to things.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, so I didn't tell you the name of the book that I used at the beginning because I didn't want you to know it was a miscarriage of justice, but the book's called Miscarriage of Justice: The Murder of Teresa de Simone by Fergus Mason. And I've told you most of it, but it's a quick read. So if you fancy like a something for a train journey,
yeah,
I'd say check it out.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you a story. As it's our final one, it's going to be another one.
She's going to murder me.
No, it's another one where the story is taken from the research of Gordon Honeycomb, who wrote Secrets of the Black Museum.
I feel like he should have some sort of investment in this podcast.
I've been faithfully using his content for many years now, amongst others, but he just writes brilliantly. His research is unparalleled. He's got
Are
two
you marrying
books.
Him?
I'm not marrying him, but I feel like now I can just plug him shamelessly because I have loved his books. They're really interesting. Nice short chapters on different people. And like I say, really good research because he's had access to the Black Museum, basically. So he's got all the stuff. So if you're feeling sad at the loss of Slaughter, I would buy his books on Amazon because they're really good reads. But you don't need to read this chapter about Günther Podola. He was born in Berlin in 1929. He was the only child of a banker. He was good at school. He played the piano, seemed like a nice kid. But life in Germany after World War One was already incredibly hard. There was huge dissatisfaction over the loss of the war and financial crisis following the Treaty of Versailles. It left many of the citizens angry, who were really keen for a strong leader to make Germany great again, of course. There's a lot of post-World War One and post-World War Two murders that are really interesting because there's some research needs to be done. There's obviously a link between people who've lived through a war and then who go on to commit murders, like the psychological effects of living through wartime.
Yeah.
It hasn't been explored fully, I don't think. So I think it's hard to really relate.
Was it Peaky Blinders that did explore?
Yeah, I think it's hard to relate to this, to Gunther, fully, because I think actually we can't know too much about his state of mind because it's just so alien to live in a situation like that where,
yeah,
like the level of, like, I just remember the little pictures in your history book at school where the kids were playing with wheelbarrows of money because it's just worthless.
Mm.
All sorts of crazy things. But so by World War II then, Gunther was in his adolescence and he was just, his playground was basically roaming the streets of the heavily bombed capital city. And like many young men, he found structure, order, belonging as part of the Hitler Youth, and is actually described as being fanatical, but I think that's part of the rules of being in it.
The whole thing was pretty fanatical. So he was a Nazi.
Well, he was in the Hitler Youth. I think that's fair to say. I don't think it's quite fair to say that he was a Nazi as such.
Okay, so the two are not the one and the same, necessarily.
Yeah, because I think a lot of the young kids, it's like, they were just indoctrinated, weren't they? Is that a bit too kind?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's other bad things that happened to him, because obviously, yes, he was a German, but perhaps due to his youth at the time, I think you could count him as maybe at least partially one of the victims of the war or some of the effects of the war. He lost his father, who was killed in Stalingrad. And then in 1945, when the war ended, as the Russian forces entered Berlin, Gunther's tower block was raided. All of the men who lived in it were taken out and were shot. And many of the women were raped. And Gunther's mother was included in that. So he's had some incredibly traumatic experiences as a child. So he was still a teenager when the war ended, and Gunther would spend the next few years of his life once again living in post-war poverty, as he ended up living in Soviet-controlled East Berlin. So he began to build some semblance of a settled life. He set up home with a lover named Ruth Quant, and they had a son together who they named Mickey. However, in 1952... the internal border between East and West Germany officially closed. So the Berlin Wall was built in 61, I want to say. And until then, although there'd been the two separate sides, you could still pass relatively freely between them. But in 1952, they were putting an end to it and closing that border. So though Gunther couldn't really have predicted all the trauma that was going to come with the Berlin Wall, he knew enough about the Soviet forces to know that, right, now we've got to get out of East Berlin. It's not before the stricter laws come. So Podola successfully fled the German Democratic Republic, but he did so without Ruth and his son. He emigrated to Canada and lived there for 6 years, but he didn't lead an honest life. He was charged with theft and burglary, and all told, he spent about a total of a year in prison. On his release, Podola was then deported back to Germany. And in 1958, he spent some time in Dusseldorf before once again seeking new life overseas, but this time in England. Ding, 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 ding. UK true crime.
I was going to say, she just like forgone all the rules today.
It's the last one. I don't give a shit.
Don't know, but fish.
Yeah, so he came to England. So, so late 60s, there would still have been a bit of post-war prejudice against a German immigrant coming to live in London, I would say. Definitely. Maybe not a threat to his life, but I think people wouldn't have been like chomping at the bit to give him a job and make friends with him. So he arrived in London in the May 1959, and he sort of fashioned himself as this generically European gangster. He lived in Soho, and he went by the name of Mike Collato. So definitely
Mike Collato.
Yeah, I think he was trying to go for a little bit of a mobster vibe. That's what he wanted everyone to think of him anyway.
Hey, it's Mikey Collato coming in for a drink.
Yeah. And he'd lived in Canada for quite a long, for like 6 years as a young man. A lot of people said that he did speak with a American Canadian accent when he wanted to, so I think he was doing a little bit of like,
I pick up an accent so fast. 6 years. Yeah.
And as Gordon says, he made a living by, quote, various legitimate though shady activities. So maybe some sort of like a scam here and there, a bit of wheeling and dealing. But as in Canada, Podola also sought to supplement his legal earnings by burgling houses at night. I mean, it didn't take him long. The 3rd of July, so he's only been here a couple of months in 1959, Podola burgled a flat in South Kensington, which belonged to a model named Mrs. Vern Schiffman. He took some of her jewellery and furs altogether, totaled about £2,000 worth of stuff at the time he took. I think Podola must have been impressed by the apartment and the wealth of what he had. So following the burglary, he felt, I'm going to rinse this woman for a bit more than I've already got. So a few days after the burglary, Mrs. Schiffman received a letter claiming to have come from a private detective called Mr. Levine, who said that he had compromising photographs and tapes of her, and that the cost of protecting her reputation would be $500. She was like, I've not done anything. They're obviously bullshitting. So she didn't respond at all. So then she received a phone call from someone claiming to be Mr. Fisher, and she then contacted the police and said, someone is definitely trying to blackmail me, and I've had this burglary. So then the next day after his first phone call, 13th of July, Podola called Mrs. Schiffman, again claiming to be this Mr. Fisher, who was working on behalf of the Mr. Levine from before. And he was saying, look, let's just get the ball rolling with this payment. What are we going to do about it? Because she'd now informed the police, they had thought it wise to tap the phone line of the flat for when he next contacted him. So Mrs. Schiffman was prepared, and she was able to keep Podola on the line for a good 15 minutes while police traced the phone call to a phone box in South Kensington Underground Station. So at 3:50 p.m., while they were still on the line, Mrs. Schiffman heard Podola call out to someone and then heard the sound of a scuffle. And then the next voice she heard was an officer who told her that he was Detective Sergeant Purdy. Basically, if you hear from me again, I'm the real deal. So DS Raymond Purdy had arrived at the telephone box with DS John Sandford from Chelsea Police Station. The two officers had dragged Podola from the box, and they began escorting him above ground to the waiting police car. But as they tried to negotiate the stairs out of the tube station, Podola managed to break free from the officer's grip and made a run for it. Gunther Podola then ran into a block of flats not far from the tube station and just hid behind a pillar to try and wait them out. But the two unarmed detectives, Purdy and Sandford, caught up with Podola once again and entered the flat and arrested him. So DS Purdy ordered Podola to sit on this marble windowsill, and he stood in front of him watching him, while DS Sandford crossed the hallway so that he could ring the bell for the caretaker to sort of either go and fetch the police. There's lots of few things. Some people said he went to fetch the police car. Some people say he rang the caretaker so that the caretaker could either go and alert the police to come and give them backup.
So they've got no radio, phone, any...
No, they need 1950s, they don't have...
They need someone to...
Yeah. And I think they didn't want to risk the two of them walking with him from the flats to the car in case he gave them the slip again.
Yeah, because he's, like, if he's quite a big guy, it can take up to, like, 6 months to take down, like, a...
Yeah, I think he was a slippery little bastard, to be honest. So while Dear Sanford was sort of turned around, like, away from the two of them, Podola took out a gun that he had hidden on his person.
Oh, shit, they didn't check him first.
No. Ugh. And he shot Raymond Purdy in the chest and then scarpered. So by the time Sanford had run over to his colleague and then out of the building, there was no sign of Padola at all. D.S. Purdy was a 40-year-old, married, father of three.
Did he die?
Yeah, basically. Oh. He'd called his wife earlier in the day saying he was going to be late. He was supposed to have finished his shift, but just as he was going, they'd had this phone call saying, all right, we've got the blackmailer on the line.
Yeah.
And so he was like, all right, I'll come along and help out. Oh. So it was a really unfortunate turn of events. But yes, the bullet had gone straight into his heart and had killed him. D.S. Sanford gave a description of Purdy's killer. He said, quote, a man about 30, height 5'10", slim build, brown hair, speaking with an American accent, last seen Canadian. Wearing dark glasses, a light sports coat, grey trousers and suede shoes.
I mean, that's a lot of different looks in one outfit.
It is. And then something was saying like he was wearing dark glasses because it was one of the hottest summers of the decade or something, but still with trousers, a sports coat, suede shoes in the summer.
That's insane.
And he's running around. They were able, however, to collect Padola's fingerprints from the windowsill in the hallway where he'd been ordered to sit. And the police also had possession of an address book, which was originally found on the body of D.S. Purdy and had been sent to his widow. But when she looked at it, she was like, this isn't ours, and returned it to the station. So they realised it must have belonged to his killer and he'd confiscated it from him as evidence. So when they looked through the contacts in this address book, it didn't have the name of him in it. It didn't have Padola's name in it anywhere, so they still didn't know who he was. But the contacts, some were German, some were Canadian. So they started ringing a few of the people and asking them if they knew someone by this description. And they all either, they gave various aliases that he had, but right. They all said that they knew someone who matched the killer. So they knew it belonged to the killer. Meanwhile, there's another little thing going off. We had a story before about like a really vigilant hotel manager and how they managed to, because of their concern for someone, it managed to catch a killer. So in this one, the manager of the Claremont House Hotel, he'd called the police because one of his guests, caught going by the name of Paul Kamei, was acting strangely. And he thought he's hiding out in the hotel. He's like, he's come home. He's not left the room for 2 days, making weird noises in there. Like, what? I need you to come and check on him.
Making weird noises.
I added that bit. I don't know.
I was going to say like...
Well, I was like, what else is acting strangely? But he thought he was hiding in there. He was making some noise. He doesn't think he's dead. He thinks he's alive in there. Yeah. Like, hiding.
Okay.
So the police showed the manager a photograph that they'd received from Canada of the German immigrant Gunther Padola. And the manager confirmed that, yeah, that's Paul Kamei who's hiding in his room. So on Thursday, the 16th of July, police went to Padola's hotel room and banged on the door. Now, there's a bit of conflicting stories. Not conflicting, but there's the account of the police. And then there's other people who've suggested that maybe they were acting inappropriately. I don't think in the end it really matters because they knew he killed a police officer. So the police said that they heard a click behind the door. And because they were looking for a man who'd shot a police officer, they assumed that this was the click of a gun being cocked.
Yeah.
So the officers charged the door and sort of crushed Padola underneath it. Not to death, but he was badly injured, as they said.
Well, they knocked it off its hinges and it fell on him.
Yeah, there's a guy, D.S. Chambers, who just, it was a really, really big 16-stone guy. He just like shoulder barged the door and it fell on top of this guy.
I mean, I imagine a lot of these people were colleagues of Purdy's and like they really want to make sure he gets caught. Like,
yeah. I mean, Padola was unarmed. They later found in the hotel attic, they found the gun that had been used to shoot D.S. Purdy, and it had been wrapped in a newspaper from the day of the murder. We know that Padola's face was badly bruised and cut. He had really black eyes that stayed for a long time. There's photographs you can see, and he's always got these black eyes. And the police put a jacket over his head as they left the hotel and put him in a car. Now you can see that on photographs as well. You could say it's just so they don't reveal his identity before he's charged, or you could say it's to hide the injuries that they've given him. But can you kind of blame them for opening the door and giving him a quick punch in the face? They didn't stab him. They didn't kill him. He just had a bit of a bashed up face. If they barged the door, they probably did hit him.
I kind of feel like if you kill a police officer, you kind of know that you're fucked. Like, they're not going to go easy on you.
Yeah.
Like, if you're ever watching a drama, you're like, oh my God, they're going to kill a police officer. That's, like, basically the worst of the worst.
But still, again, in their defense as well, it's not like they went out to try and give him a beating. Like, they thought he had a weapon because they knew that he'd shot someone. They would be right in thinking he could be armed behind there. We need to use force. So I'm not like judging anyone for it.
No,
I'm just saying, like, did you punch him though? Which is kind of fine. But neither Padola nor his lawyers complained about his treatment by the police. He was examined by a doctor half an hour after his arrival at Chelsea Police Station. And Padola presented signs of being in severe shock. He was shivering. He was really dazed. So much so that he was taken to hospital the next day, where he was looked over by doctors completely. They found no signs of fractures or internal bleeding. So they really didn't give him, like, the beating of his life at all. I think it probably was the door. Maybe a little quick punch underneath the door. That's it.
Yeah.
But again, they commented on the fact that Padola was in real shock, like clinical shock, and he wasn't fully aware of his surroundings at all. So over the next few days, as he began to recover in hospital, he was there for about 4 days. Padola claimed to have almost no memory of his life at all before the arrest.
What?
Like, anything. Didn't know the names of his...
Like, amnesia.
Yeah, complete amnesia. Didn't know the names of his family, didn't know where he lived, didn't know where he'd been. Nothing about his life he could tell them. There was noted that he asked a lot of questions about his situation, sort of, where am I, why am I here? But it was said that it was noted as being interesting that he never asked why he was chained to the bed, like why he was handcuffed.
And you think it's all bullshit, and it was heavily disputed.
On the 20th of July, there began a trial. But it wasn't the full murder trial. Basically, they needed to have a trial to determine whether or not he was fit to stand trial for murder.
Yeah.
He was transported to Brixton Prison, where he was staying while they were awaiting this, for the next few weeks. He was seen by numerous doctors, for both the defence and the prosecution, to try and ascertain if this memory loss was real or not. And on the 10th of September... they were to present this evidence to a judge. So, really, because basically, if he couldn't remember anything at all, he wasn't able to mount a defence. And if he couldn't defend himself, then he couldn't be tried for murder. Even if Sandford had witnessed him kill someone, say, because you have that right to a defence. So,
yeah,
it's a really weird one. Groundbreaking case in that it's one of the first times this really taken place, because we know he did it, but is that enough to do it without letting him stand up for himself, basically? So Padola's lawyer presented the findings of five doctors who all felt that the amnesia was most likely real. They said that yes, you can fake something, but the things that he did remember compared to things that he didn't were really consistent with other cases of amnesia. So, right. For example, it's his long-term biographical memory that's gone, but things like acquired skills he still had. So, like, he could still speak English. He could still knew the rules to games. He could play games. Mm. But it was more sort of just details about his own life that he couldn't remember. And they're saying, actually, that's generally how it happens with the parts of the brain that are affected. Yeah. It's not just like you're wiped clean. So then, like I said, they were, there's evidence on the other side, doctors saying that it definitely was, he was fit to stand trial for murder. This was all just a ploy. But eventually the jury at the time decided that amnesia had not been fully established and that he was fit to stand trial. So a new trial began on the 24th of September with the same lawyers, same judge, but a different jury. So to try and make it as fair as possible. Padola did go into the witness stand, but basically just got up there and made a statement about the fact that I can't defend myself. I don't know anything about this event.
Yeah.
His lawyers, similarly, they made statements to say, look, we have no defense here. Like, he can't tell us anything, so we can't present anything to you. And we're just trying to hammer it home. However, D.S. Sandford testified for the prosecution and was saying, I saw him shoot T.S. Purdy. So that was pretty much that, to be honest. The jury at the time felt that even though he wasn't able to make a defence, it didn't matter in the long run.
Really?
So Gunther
Padola, I guess you can't just let him go. It's either not guilty for reason of insanity or guilty, really. Like,
yeah. And yeah, because this is why it was such an important case, because reason of insanity, they were trying to basically make an exception to the fact that he was insane, but the definition of by reason of insanity is that you aren't making the choice to kill based in reason. But in this case, he would have known his reasons right or wrong at the time. It's since then.
He just can't remember them. He can't stand trial. He wasn't insane to commit the murder, but he's now insane.
Yeah.
In a sort of like sense to plead.
Yeah. So
it is weird.
But I guess if he had a good defense, maybe he would have avoided a death penalty, or he would have had mitigating steps. Like, there could have been other parts to it.
We've looked at cases before where it's been a long time before it came to trial, and then the person at that point is like quite old and frail and stuff. Usually they've sort of reached a deal, I think.
Yeah. I think maybe the other side of it is that it was a police officer that was killed. Yeah. Might have been another side of this. But Gunther Padola was sentenced to death, and he was hanged at Wandsworth Prison on November 1959. He was the last person to be hanged for killing a police officer.
Okay.
So not the last person to kill one or the last person to be hanged, but
yeah,
he's got an award on there somewhere.
He's got something.
And that is the last murderer to be discussed by me on the Slaughter Podcast. Not forever. I said for the near future.
Oh, okay, right.
Let me finish a sentence.
Okay, so we really loved it, you guys, and we really want to thank a lot of you for it, particularly if you've listened right from the beginning. I mean, good going. Or like listened to them all and got this far. Thank you so much to everyone who supported us on Patreon. I have like stopped taking your money now, but thank you so much. It's really meant, like, you know, when I've been having a really tired week, I've thought, people are paying for this shit. I gotta suck it up.
It's still overwhelming to think that people ever wanted to do that, and they enjoyed it so much. So we will always appreciate you guys for thinking so highly of us.
And thank you for all the people who left reviews. You can still leave us reviews. Obviously, the podcast's gonna stay up. You can listen to old episodes. We're just not gonna be producing any content, at least for now. You know, one of us or both of us might come back at some point. But also, true crime's pretty busy these days.
It is. There's some fabulous people out there that we can recommend you go listen to. I'm not going to name them now. Bitches, this is our moment. But there's other stuff for you. Go read some Gordon Honeycomb. But yeah, and our Facebook group, they've been amazing. The people that came to us when we had our meetup, I still see their names pop up in our group. You are the best. That's cute.
Yeah, we're going to miss you all. But you can, we'll still have the email up, thoughtofthepodcast@gmail.com. And we're not going to like shut down the Twitter or the Instagram. I'm not sure how often I'll be on them, but they're not going to disappear forever.
Yeah.
So take care, guys, and until we meet again. Bye.
Yeah. Bye. Bye.
Oh, God.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts?
Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.